And welcome everyone to today's broadcast of the FRTR Presents PFAS Emerging Characterization and Remedial Technologies. This is session one. I'd like to introduce you to your two speakers before I turn it over to the co-moderator. We're going to be joined by two presenters. First, we'll have Linda Gaines, who works here at EPA as an environmental engineer and environmental health scientist. Previously, she worked as a consultant performing environmental site assessments and water and wastewater work. She has been here in the Superfund Science Policy Branch in the area of human health risk assessments. And she also maintains the Superfund Chemical Database Matrix and the regional screening levels. The majority of her time is spent as the Superfund subject matter expert for PFAS. Then we'll then be joined by a second presenter, Ramona Irie. She works at the Naval Facilities Engineering and Expeditionary Warfare Center. And she is a physical scientist there, where she has more than 10 years of experience in the field of environmental remediation. Her areas of expertise include fate and transport, site characterization, long-term monitoring, and remediation of contaminants like chlorinated solvents, petroleum hydrocarbons, and emerging contaminants like PFAS. She has been working with PFAS for the past 5 years in the areas of site characterization, granular activated carbon treatment, and regeneration, and researching remedial technologies. So I want to thank both of those speakers for joining us, and I would ask Cindy Frickle, if you're there on the line, if you could come on and share a little bit of information about today's sponsor, the FRTR.
Yes, thank you, Jean. I just want to let everyone know that the Federal Remediation Technologies Roundtable is the sponsor of this event. So FRTR has these meetings twice a year where folks come together in the D.C. area from many member agencies. These include Department of Defense agencies, Energy, Interior, the Environmental Protection Agency, NASA, National Institutes of Health, and others. These folks all come together with the mission to build a collaborative atmosphere to help in hazardous waste site cleanup. So we work primarily with technologies and just trying to get information out to other agencies and to the public about cleanup technologies for hazardous waste sites. So the two presenters that you're going to hear from today are presenting materials that were delivered at a meeting late in 2018. This one was focused on PFAS, emerging characterization and remedial technologies. We will have another session coming up later this year, also on that topic. We'll give you some more information about that at the end of today's webinar. But I just want to thank our speakers today for coming back and doing this webinar. And if you're curious about what FRTR is up to, I encourage you to check out frtr.gov. And if you go to frtr.gov/meetings, that will tell you about what meetings have happened recently and are coming up. And like I said, those are open to the public. So Jean, I'll hand it back to you.
Thank you so very much. All right, with that, I'll go ahead and call up the presentation materials for our very first speaker, Linda Gaines. Linda, whenever you're ready, please feel free to begin.
Okay, well, thank you. Hello, everyone. My name is Linda Gaines. As Dean already said, I work in Superfund at EPA. So good afternoon or good morning, depending upon which time zone you're in. So I'm just going to give a little, basically my presentation is kind of an introduction of what are PFAS and what are the problems with them. So let's see, here we go. Okay. So probably you have heard of PFAS before, but PFAS refers to per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances. It is a group of thousands of chemicals. I tend to subgroup them by the functional group. All of them have, you'll have carbons that are completely fluorinated, and somewhere in there, there's going to be a functional group. Most subgroups have ranges of chain links. So, for example, many people are familiar with PFOA, which is a carboxylic acid with 8 carbons. There are carboxylic acids that go all the way down to probably 2 carbons. And they go all the way up to maybe 14 carbons. I couldn't tell you the exact amount, but in other words, most of these functional groups have all these various different chain lengths. So PFAS are highly fluorinated, as you can tell by the name. They are highly resistant to degradation, both biological and physical chemical degradation. They're very mobile. Most of them are actually surfactants. And they have varying and many times unknown levels of toxicity. We don't even know the structures of all of them, and we're lacking a lot of information. One other note, you may have heard the term PFC before. So some people probably still do refer to PFAS as PFCs, which stands for perfluorinated chemicals. One of the reasons that most of us have moved away from that term is that PFC can also stand for perfluorinated carbons, which are kind of a different group of chemicals, and they're actually refrigerants. So just to avoid confusion, just so you know, PFAS and PFC can mean the same thing. So as I said, there's thousands of different chemicals that are in fact PFAS. So I've just sort of brought up the chemical structures of a smattering of different chemicals. Top one, the perfluorotetradecanoic acid. So again, this is a carboxylic acid. So this is analogous to PFOA, only it has a total of 14 carbons, whereas PFOA is 8 carbons. Perfluorohexane sulfonoic acid, that is analogous to PFOS. This one is actually being kind of used as a replacement for PFOS. It is like PFOS, only it has 2 less carbons. So I'm not going to go through all of them. You can see that they're all these different structures. Gen X, that's actually, it's HFPO dimer acid, is otherwise known as Gen X. That is made by Chemours, I think, exclusively. Below that is Adana, which is made by 3M. Okay, so I'm going to actually give you a pop quiz. So in your screen, you should see a little box that has where you can answer which one of these do you think is PFOA. So you've got 4 choices, or actually you got 5. You can either say it's one of those, or maybe you think it's all 4 of them are in fact PFOA. So why don't y'all go ahead and just take a moment and make your guess, because don't worry, we are not in fact grading you. So feel free to just go ahead and vote if you're not sure. Okay, good. We're getting some responses. So I'm going to give it just a couple of seconds more, so everybody quickly pretend like you're on Jeopardy. You've got to quickly answer.
Look alive, people.
Okay, great. Well, so it looks like the majority of you think the answer is E, and about a third of you think that the answer is B. So the correct answer is, in fact, all of them. B, which about a third of you guessed at, do not feel bad for voting B. That the straight chain molecule is what most people associate with PFOA. Similarly for PFOS, the same thing. But in reality, because of the manner in which they are being made, you can get all these different branching types. So as long as it has 8 carbons and they're fluorinated except for the 1 carbon on the carboxylic acid, that's still PFOA. And in fact, literally yesterday I was looking at a list of different chemicals trying to get CAF numbers, and I believe there were 39 different isomers for PFOA alone, all of which had CAF numbers. So there's a lot of them. So just so you know, And it's also important to note with analytical methods, which I'll get to a little bit later, I got to remember to talk about that. With analytical methods, be sure what the lab is telling you. Are they telling you about straight chain? Are they telling you about the total of the straight chain plus branched? Okay, let's see. Did I push the right button? So what are PFAS used for? Well, basically everything, and I'm only being slightly hyperbolic with that. They're used in a wide variety of industries and a wide variety of commercial products. They have, in fact, really valuable properties, fire resistance, dust suppression. Most people kind of associate them with AFFF, which is aqueous film-forming foam, which is used to fight hydrocarbon fires. They are also used to make polymers such as Teflon, PTFE. I don't want to use product names, but all those various stain-resistant products, non-slip type stuff. But they've also got more kind of industrial-type applications. They're used in the dust suppression for chrome plating, used in just in manufacturing electronics. They're used in a lot of different cleaning products, both industrial and consumer. So for the PFAS universe, as I'll call it, for, you know, what type of sites where you might find them, again, a wide variety of different industries, the metal plating, plastics and textile coating, plastics and chemical manufacturing. Car washes use many car washes use PFAS in the different products and the wax application, which doesn't mean to say that there's going to be contamination there. It just means that they're using them there. Of course, waste disposal, obviously, whatever waste goes in there, you know, there you go. And so if you have an unlined landfill, if PFAS had gone in, then you very well may have it coming out into the groundwater if you don't have a liner. So then, of course, AFFF is used, it's not, you know, we sort of associate it with military airfields, but it's also associated with commercial airports, fire training areas, chemical refineries. So when discussing releases, it's always good when you're doing your conceptual site model, you need to think about all the different pathways in which the PFAS could have been released. So of course with, you know, AFFF, okay, where was it used, where was it stored, where was it tested? So, you know, groundwater and soil, you can come out the wastewater depending upon where it was released. Biosolids application is a problem. The biosolids can be applied to the soil and then it'll leach into the groundwater. Leachate, of course. It can come out in the leachate. I've also seen evidence it can, in fact, come out the landfill gas. So the more volatile PFAS will volatilize into that landfill gas. And then with manufacturing, consider, you know, your wastewater, where the solids are going, but also consider air deposition. There are some PFAS that are volatile, but even PFAS that are not volatile, some of them still, like aerosols, can come out the stack. And so that can lead to air deposition. So in terms of, like, which specific PFAS we are finding, I originally presented this a couple of years ago saying, you know, I had to divide that for PFAS sites that I was familiar with and I knew what some of the analysis was, and I had divided that between AFFF sites and then non-AFFF sites, but I decided that really wasn't a good way to present it because it turns out basically every single PFAS site that I'm familiar with has a wide variety of PFAS. I've never seen a site with one and only one PFAS, and you'll get the carboxylic acids, C4 to C14 have been detected. For the sulfonic acids, C4 to C10 have been detected. The various fluoropolymer sulfonates, PFOSA, basically what you look for, you very well may find. So it's just important to note what is your analytical method looking for, and just know that you're probably going to find a wide variety. Various media can be affected, of course, the groundwater and the soil. The surface water, of course, can be affected. Biota, of course, if it gets into the environment, it can get into fish and, you know, we're always concerned about fish, I think, but we can be concerned about fruits and vegetables. I put deer on here because I believe it was Michigan. There was a deer advisory. Some of the PFAS, I'm not sure which one, I think it was PFAS, was found in deer meat, and they put an advisory for that. Honey, that was a concern in North Carolina that apparently the honey was analyzed for the Gen X chemicals. They did find some, but as I recall, it wasn't like a large concentration, and you would have had to, consume a lot of honey for it to be of concern. So what do we know about the toxicity? Unfortunately, we know some, but there's a lot of information that's outstanding. So the EPA Office of Water released reference doses for PFOA and PFOS in 2016, and the RFDs were 2 times 10 to the negative 5 milligrams per kilogram per day. This led to a lifetime drinking water health advisory of 70 parts per trillion. And the health advisory is based on the sum of PFOA and PFOS concentrations combined. Now, the Office of Water also, within the health effects support document for PFOA, they derived an oral slope factor for PFOA. However, the non-cancer, the reference dose, actually is the risk driver for most equations. The Superfund Office at EPA has a provisional peer-reviewed toxicity value reference dose for PFBS that was published in 2014. And then, let's see, ATSDR has a draft toxicological profile out where they derived MRLs for PFOA, PFOS, PFNA, and PFHXS. EPA also now has out draft values for, it's an updated PFBS number, and also there is a draft value for HFPO dimer, aka Gen X. And of course, various states have derived their own toxicity values or risk levels or standards. So just to discuss a little more, if you're not normally involved with risk assessment, there are toxicity values that are derived, and you put that into an exposure equation, and that's how you get risk. So that's important to note, because some states have been using the Office of Water reference dose, the toxicity value, and they put them into different exposure equations, and then they come up with different risk numbers or different standards. Let's see. PFOA, PFOS, PFNA, and PFHXS have somewhat similar toxicity, but PFBS is less toxic. And I just have a table on here just to sort of allow you to look at the relative numbers, how they compare. And of course, it's important to note I have noted that some of those values are in fact draft. And I obviously did not cover them. A lot of states have their own values. This is just to sort of give a little intro of the different values out there. So, analysis. Currently, we have EPA's Office of Water has method 537.1, which is for 18 PFAS in drinking water. It was updated last year. Before, it was just 537, and it was for 14. They've updated it to now include 18 PFAS. There are two ASTM methods. They're both single lab validated. One of them is for PFAS in non-potable waters, and one of them is for soils. And both of these use direct injection. Okay, so another time for a quiz. I know, this is difficult. I'm testing everyone. So, you very well may see commercial labs running what they call modified method 537.1 for analysis. So how do you think it is modified? Because 537.1 is for drinking water. So do you think they modify it for other media so they can run, you know, non-potable waters or soils? Do they modify it for other analytes because it only covers 18, so maybe they're doing extra analytes? Have they modified it to include isotope dilution? Do you think it's something else? Do you think it's all of them? You're just not sure what they're doing. Okay. All right. Answers are coming in. There's no pressure because there's no grade, right? Okay. Very good. So I tell you what, I'm going to give you like 2 more seconds. So everybody get their vote in really quick. Okay. So not quite the majority of you think the answer is all of the above. About 20% think it's other media. Some of you think it's other analytes. Some of you think it's isotope dilution. So in reality, I'm not completely sure there is, in fact, a correct answer to this. My thinking is the answer is yes and maybe. I really don't know. And the reason I say that is because quite obviously if you have a lab analyzing for something by what's called, what they're calling modified method 537, and it comes back and they've analyzed it for some PFAS that is not in 537, well, you know they've modified it to put other analytes in it. But the truth is we generally don't, there's no such thing in reality as modified method 537. So if they, you're really not completely sure what they're doing. I mean, they will hopefully tell you what they're doing, and you will be able to figure out if they're doing it for other analytes or if they've done it for other media. But this isn't standardized. There's no real thing. So the point of all that is, if you're using a lab and they're using modified method 537.1, have a conversation with them. What do they mean by that? What exactly are they doing? So it's more of just a warning to have a conversation with your lab. Find out what they're doing. Okay, cool. So more on analytical methods. So the EPA, what do we have in progress? Currently we have, there is a draft of SW846, method 8327. This is for a direct inject method of 24 PFAS in non-potable waters. I'm very happy to announce, something's not in print, that this will be out for public comment within the week. It may be seen as early as tomorrow. So it'll be out for a 30-day public comment period. So be on the law, be watching out for that. Okay. There is SW846 method 8328, which is solid phase extraction isotopic dilution method. It's for 24 PFAS in non-potable waters and also for solids. That is in the works. That's basically all I can say at this point is we are working on it. And finally, there has been some work done on a draft direct inject method for 24 PFAS in soils. So when you're sampling for PFAS, first of all, PFAS are ubiquitous. So you need to take precautions to avoid contamination of samples. There was a joke going around for a couple of years. I'm not sure if it's still going around, that pretty soon everybody's going to have to be sampling naked because everything has PFAS. Your sunscreen might have PFAS in it. Of course, if you're wearing, you know, your stain-resistant steel-toed boots or stain-resistant, you know, jacket, of course, that might have PFAS in it. It probably does have PFAS in it. You know, pizza boxes might have PFAS in them. So bug spray is apparently a no-no. So basically, I can't tell you what you can use and what can't you use, but be careful. Look at labels of products, and, you know, there are certain things you just don't bring into the field. Don't bring into the field your weather-resistant clothing and your waterproof notebook. Those most likely have PFAS in them and can cause cross-contamination. If you're sampling from existing wells, they may have PFAS-leaching components which could cause contamination. Like, they might have Teflon tape involved somewhere in there. Finally, as I've already mentioned, consideration for personal care products and clothing because of potential contamination. So challenges that we have. You know, I work in Superfund, and one of our challenges is no PFAS are currently CERCLA hazardous substances, so we can't cost recover under CERCLA. And however, CERCLA authorities can be triggered if PFAS release or threat of release presents an imminent and substantial endangerment to public health or welfare, because PFAS can be considered contaminant or pollutant or contaminant. You may know from the PFAS action plan that we are working to designate PFO and PFOS as hazardous substances, though. So, but currently they're not. There are no federal MCLs. Again, that was something in the action plan about PFOA and PFAS working towards a regulatory decision on MCLs for PFOA and PFAS. And finally, numerous states have, in fact, derived their own advisories and cleanup levels. So, you know, basically, if you work in more than one state, you just need to be paying attention to what your respective state is doing and what kind of standards do they have. Some more cleanup challenges, because there's lots. We only have final, well, we EPA, or actually we Superfund to a certain extent, only have final toxicity information for PFOA, PFAS, and PFBS. Again, there's many draft values out there. Also, many states have their own values. And then currently, EPA Method 537.1, which is used for drinking water, is the only validated method that we have. And as I've said, we're working on others. So, let's see. When you have a site with groundwater, all media really, dispersion potential for PFAS will differ both by type and by the length of the carbon chain. The shorter, for the most part, seem to migrate faster. So if you have a mix of PFAS, like your shorter chain PFAS might be on the leading edge of your plume, whereas your long chain PFAS might not have migrated quite as much. Migration will depend upon the carbon content of the soil, especially the carbon content. Also, for example, fluorotolamide alcohols are volatile, but others can be dispersed in air as particulates. Finally, ecological uptake differs, so just basically pay attention to what your PFAS is and what your receptor is. Finally, more cleanup challenges. For drinking water, groundwater remediation, there is granulated activated carbon, there is ion exchange and reverse osmosis, there's potential incompatibility with other contaminant remediation, such as if you're oxidizing, you've got an oxidation in there for another contaminant that can actually lead to precursors being oxidized to form more of the final PFAS. Finally, with soil, for the most part, the methods are dig and haul or potentially oxidation. So there's a lot of work being done with the remediation methods, but there's still a lot of work that needs to be done. And that's it.
All right. Thank you, Linda. We have had a ton of questions flooding in for you, so we're going to keep you busy for a few more minutes.
Okay.
So first quick question is, someone asked if these compounds are still in use, or has that changed much?
Yeah, so they are still in use. The it seems to be that there seems to be a discontinuation of the longer chain PFAS, so before they might have been using PFOA, and so now they're using PFHXA or PFBA, so moving to the shorter ones. There does seem to be a change in the different chemistry of, so for example, if you're familiar with the North Carolina Chemours situation, it's a different PFAS chemistry from what I have termed classical PFAS, for lack of a better term, because I don't think any of these are really new or old. So PFAS in general, PFAS as a class, are still in use. It's just, it's changing which particular PFAS are being used.
Okay, so on that note, is there a relation in toxicity between, like just a overall kind of generalization, like are shorter chain less toxic and longer chain more, or any, can we make any kind of conclusions like that yet?
I don't know. So the shorter the chain, the shorter the half-life in the human body. That part, there does seem to be an actual relationship. But of course, shorter half-life in the human body doesn't necessarily mean it's less toxic. The information we have right now is shorter chain tend to be less toxic, but the truth is there's just so much we don't know. It's really hard to develop, wide-ranging notions. And also in terms of when you get into these different PFAS, like the ethers and, these different functional groups, it's really hard to figure out, like, it's hard to even draw any type of rule of thumb. Mm-hmm. So.
Right. Okay. So we're still figuring that out. Okay, so let's see. We had some folks ask kind of how did we first find out about the risks associated with PFAS? Like, when did it first come to our attention? And, like, I guess there was some sort of, like, why wasn't it clear? But I know you've been working on it for a little while now.
Yeah.
So how long has it been since this came on your plate? And, like,
apparently a lifetime. I'm pretty sure I first started working on PFAS in 2014 before then. And I remember when I first started working on it, I'm like, what the heck are these things? I've got a bachelor's in chemical engineering. I had never heard of any of this stuff before. I think the first, like, kind of real instance of this stuff hitting the news, I think, was Washington, the DuPont Washington Works facility in West Virginia. And you can look, if you look up Washington Works and C8 study, there was a lot of work done, and that was in the 2000s. I want to say, like, maybe 2004 or something. Don't anybody quote me on that one. I know we had a provisional health advisory for PFOA and for PFOS. Those came out in 2009 because of a situation in Alabama and Georgia with, I think it had to do with biosolids being applied. And then kind of after that, that's when it went back to the scientists, okay, start getting some more work done, you know, start doing more research into this. But the earliest known manufacturer of, like, a PFAS chemical was the 40s. They've been used since, I believe the earliest data I've seen is 1954 for chrome plating for the dust suppression. They've been used since, yeah, I want to say it's the 60s for AFFF. So they've been around for quite a while.
Okay. All right, we've got a few questions about kind of transport of PFAS. One listener asked, so let's say you have a water body that's impacted with PFAS. If that water evaporates, is PFAS evaporating with it and mobile in air, or is it thankfully?
That's such a darn good question. It would seem, based on the information I have, like, your shorter chain or the more volatile ones, like the fluoretoluene alcohols, those are volatile, so those probably will go into the atmosphere. The longer chain ones are probably going to, like, stay in the water. The little bit I know, kind of rule of thumb, is that PFAS love the interface. They love the interface between air and water, between water and sediments. They're surfactants. They love being, between two different media. So I don't know.
It kind of depends. Right?
Yeah, I think so, yes.
Okay. So I think this is kind of along those lines, too. Someone asked about, it seems that the RSLs for PFAS are relatively high for soil compared to groundwater.
Mm-hmm.
Is that because of transport in groundwater versus something in soil, or can you comment on that at all?
So when you calculate the screening levels, so the I think what's kind of the question is going for is, when we calculate screen levels, when we calculate risk, it's for PFAS, it's solely about the ingestion, which is not to say these don't have inhalation toxicity. They very well may, but we don't have any values for it. So you're just considering the ingestion. So when you're looking at soil, when you're looking at groundwater, it all has to do with the exposure of. So if you're using, like, a normal Superfund equation for soil, essentially you're looking at incidental ingestion of soil with the child. And I think we assume children essentially eat a gram of soil a day or something along that lines. I know as a kid I was eating more than that. But anyway, but, like, with drinking water, we assume a child drinks, I want to say it's 1.8 liters of water a day. So in other words, it all has to do with how much they're actually ingesting. So whereas we do, I know we calculate screening levels both for the actual, the contact, the ingestion of the soil, like residential, but we also look at the migration of soils, groundwater. And I think the soil groundwater numbers are actually lower. The only issue with those is there's some question about the actual migration parameters, like when you're looking at the KOC, when you're looking at like the specific physiochemical parameters we use. We need more information on those, I guess, is where I'm going with that.
Okay. And can you touch on what kind of impacts organic carbon in soil might have on movement of, or transport of PFAS?
So what seems to be occurring is that PFAS love carbon. So in other words, if you have a highly organic, if you have soil with a lot of organic carbon in it, the PFAS are probably going to cling to the soil more tightly than if you have, you know, some type of soil, like, I don't know, clay or something that has, like, no organic content. It's probably going to move through that faster.
Okay. I think we are going to close down this section of the Q&A with that. Oh, one last thing. Maybe Linda can tell folks how to find out when 8327 is released and where they can go for that info.
Not positive. I know it's going to be in the docket because I know we've uploaded stuff. So I'm not positive if a Google search of 8327 will work, but I'm sorry. I'm actually not completely positive.
Okay. Let's do this then. Let's. You said that that should be out pretty soon, right?
Yeah, it should be out within the next week.
Any day now, basically.
Yes, exactly.
So we will go ahead and add a link to this on this webinar. So that folks, you can come back to this webinar page, look in the related URLs, mm-hmm. and we'll put a link to the docket.
Okay, that sounds good. So everybody have to come back.
Okay. Now, with that, we're going to go ahead and switch on over to our next speaker, Ramona Irie. Okay, Ramona, are you there? Are you ready to go?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, thanks. Ramona, go ahead, please start.
Okay, all right. Well, thanks, Jean, and hello, everyone. For the next 30 minutes or so, I'll be presenting to you an overview of some of the most frequently used treatment technologies for PFAS compounds. So we will discuss both water treatment technologies as well as soil treatment technologies. The water treatment technologies tend to be more pump and treat technologies, and then we'll talk some about the soil treatment technologies before we wrap up. So what this slide is showing you is a summary of some of the technologies available for drinking water treatment. These are mainly ex situ treatment technologies, and they fall into treatment categories like sorption, membrane filtration, coagulation, and redox. When it comes to sorption technologies, there's activated carbon, anion exchange, and also some minerals like clays and also biochars. The most frequently used sorption technologies are activated carbon and anion exchange, and these are commercialized and can be purchased from vendors. And then when it comes to membrane filtration, there's reverse osmosis and nanofiltration. These have been shown to work really well to remove PFAS from water, and these are commercialized and can also be purchased from vendors. And then there is coagulation technologies. Those are more being studied by researchers. I'm aware of one, PolyDadMac, that's available and I believe can be purchased, but these are less frequently used. And then we have the redox technologies, which include electrochemical oxidation. And we'll talk about one technology, electrochemical oxidation, that's currently under development. So on this table, you see there are three technologies with asterisks next to them. Those are the three that we will talk in more detail on today, during today's webinar. So we'll talk more about activated carbon, anion exchange, and also electrochemical oxidation. And as I mentioned to you, when it comes to drinking water treatment, it's mainly pump and treat technologies that we currently have. Those can be applied at the wellhead, and those are typically bigger systems, as you can see in this top right picture. And also, they can be used at point of use and also the point of entry treatment systems. And these point of entry systems are often installed like at a home in the basement, and you can see that in the picture, the bottom picture on this slide. And other than removing the PFAS from drinking water, these treatment technologies, pump and treat technologies, can be used to control the plume size and the spread of the plume, and also sometimes they're used at the base boundary to prevent the plume from migrating off-site. But currently, when it comes to treating water and removing PFAS from water, pump and treat technologies are the most practical at this point for us. So let's talk about granular activated carbon for a few minutes. So granular activated carbon is often made from bituminous coal, or it can also be made from coconut. You've probably heard of coconut carbon. It's highly porous, has a large surface area, and right now granular activated carbon is the most popular and the most widely used. And that's probably because it's the lowest cost, but it also has a really high absorption capacity. So the GAC has been shown to work really well. And this activated carbon, one of the processes to make this activated carbon is agglomeration. This process makes the carbon activated in a more even, homogeneous manner, improving its absorption capacity. So activated carbon is often added into flow-through vessels. That's how it's used in an ex-situ treatment system. These vessels can be placed in a lead-lag series configuration, where the water first goes through one column with GAC, then a second column with GAC. Or it can be placed in parallel, where the water to be treated goes through multiple columns with GAC at the same time. And the GAC can be virgin or reactivated. Reactivated meaning this carbon was previously used to remove PFAS or another contaminant, and then it was reactivated. That contaminant was removed off of the GAC, and then the GAC can be used again to treat water. So in terms of the mechanism, what is actually happening when we expose PFAS-contaminated water to GAC? It's pretty much an absorption process. It's a physical process where the PFAS are pulled out of the water and they absorb onto the granular activated carbon. So we're not having any transformation of the PFAS or chemical degradation of the PFAS when we're using activated carbon. It's really just an absorption process. And we've seen that GAC has a capacity of 90 to 99% removal of PFAS from water. So GAC, you know, it works really well, and that's why it's one of the most frequently used technologies right now to remove PFAS from water. During Linda's presentation, you know, she mentioned to you that there are maybe 1,000 or more different PFAS compounds. And different PFAS compounds break through GAC at different times. So that is one thing to keep in mind when you're using GAC to remove PFAS from water. For instance, the GAC capacity for PFAS is higher than the GAC capacity for PFOA. And also, when it comes to those shorter chain PFAS compounds that Linda mentioned, those tend to break through the GAC much faster. So the GAC capacity for these shorter chain compounds is less than that of PFAS and PFOA. So that's important to know when you're using this GAC. Also, if you have high organic carbon content in your water, that may foul your GAC and reduce the effectiveness of the GAC. So often a pre-treatment is placed on these systems where you can remove your activated carbon before sending your contaminated water through the GAC. So let's look at a little bit of data that we have here. I mentioned to you that we have bituminous carbon and also coconut carbon. So So what these graphs show you here is a comparison of how the bituminous activated carbon, the bituminous coal activated carbon works in comparison to the coconut carbon. And this data is from rapid small-scale column tests. So this is not a full-scale system. It's a small-scale system that pretty much mimics how a large-scale system would work. So let's look a little bit closer at these slides. Just getting the pointer. Okay. So the graph on the left, the influent concentration of PFOA that was exposed to the GAC was around, let's say, 900 ppt. This is shown in pink. The average influent concentration is about 900 ppt. The EPA health advisory is around 70 ppt. So the PFOA concentration is quite a bit higher than the EPA health advisory. So the performance of the coconut carbon is shown in the green and the blue lines. And notice that at the exit of the system, so this is effluent concentration in the green and the blue line, we see breakthrough beyond the concentration, the EPA health advisory concentration, just at about, let's say, somewhere between 1,000 and 5,000 bed volumes is where we have breakthrough. And this is our coconut carbon. Now, looking at our bituminous carbon, which is shown in the blue line, we see breakthrough happening more around 20,000 bed volumes. So in this instance, with this water, the bituminous carbon performed much better than the coconut carbon. We got breakthrough from the coconut carbon just after about 2,000 to 5,000 bed volumes, and breakthrough of the bituminous carbon around 20,000 bed volumes. Now let's look at one of the shorter chain PFAS compounds, PFBS. Let's see, this is a four-carbon compound, and let's see how that one performed in the presence of coconut carbon and bituminous carbon. So the coconut carbon effluent performance is shown in this green line, and the bituminous carbon is shown by the blue line. And notice, again, we see a much faster breakthrough of the short chain PFAS compounds to the coconut carbon here, around 10,000 bed volumes or so. Whereas the bituminous carbon, around 60,000 bed volumes before we saw breakthrough of this PFBS. So in this instance, we see that the bituminous carbon performed much better than the coconut carbon. And all of the data that I'm showing you today is publicly available, and I've included the references on the slide. So if you would like to look at the data in closer detail after this presentation. So on an earlier slide, I mentioned to you the thermal reactivation process. So after you have used activated carbon to remove PFAS from your water, you can actually have that carbon reactivated for use again. And how this is done is at really high temperatures, 1300 degrees Fahrenheit to about 1700 degrees Fahrenheit. And typically it's done under a negative pressure and a nitrogen environment. We have to use a nitrogen environment because if it were done in oxygen, the activated carbon would just turn into ash. So it's done under a nitrogen environment where there's no oxygen to preserve that activated carbon. What happens is the PFAS burns off of the carbon, and that off gas is passed through a couple other treatment technologies to ensure that any PFAS that's volatilized and hasn't become pyrolyzed doesn't just go off into the atmosphere. And using reactivated GAC has a lower footprint than using the virgin GAC. So you can have your carbon reactivated after it's been used to treat PFAS. And so far, it's been seen to be just as effective as the virgin carbon. So let's look at some more data from an actual site. This is a Navy base, Brunswick. This base had an existing groundwater extraction treatment system to treat volatile organic carbons. This existing treatment system used air stripping as well as GAC to remove the volatile organic compounds from the vapor phase and also from the liquid phase. Then 1,4-dioxane was found in the water, so they added a hypox unit, which is advanced oxidation unit to remove the 1,4-dioxane. And then PFAS was found at the site, so they used GAC to remove the PFAS. So let's take a look at some of the data on how the system performed to remove these PFAS compounds. So take a look at the first graph to the left. We're looking at PFAS concentration at Brunswick at the influent and effluent of the system. The blue line shows you influent concentration over time. Effluent concentration of PFAS is shown by the purple line and also by the green line. The green line shows the effluent at the midpoint. And you can see we haven't had any breakthrough of the PFAS beyond the US EPA health advisory for the pretty much the life of the system. Now, we did have a change out of carbon after about, let's say, 9 months or so. And that's because for this system, they decided to change out when there was a breakthrough of PFOA. And right now we're looking at PFAS. So let's look at the PFOA graph. Again, the influent concentration is shown by the blue line. The EPA health advisory is this solid blue line that's at the bottom of the graph. And you can see at the midpoint, that is after the first vessel, this is the MAT2 vessel, a lead and a lag vessel. At the midpoint, we're seeing some breakthrough happening here after about 9 or 10 months. We're seeing PFOA breaking through, and then the system was changed, where the lead vessel was replaced and the bituminous activated carbon was used. And immediately, we saw concentration in the effluent go below the EPA health advisory. So in this system, we see that they had coconut carbon in the lead vessel, and that was able to remove the PFAS and the PFOA, followed by bituminous carbon in the lag vessel, both able to remove the PFAS and PFOA, and we did have some breakthrough after about 10 months or so. So they changed the lead vessel, and then we had concentrations pretty back below the EPA health advisory. One thing I'd like to show you in this slide, so I mentioned that HYPOX unit, which is an advanced oxidation process. Some of you may be aware or have heard in the industry that advanced oxidation doesn't really work very well to oxidize PFAS compounds, so it's not really a technology of choice. And take a look at the effluent of both PFAS and PFOA from this HYPOX unit. It's shown in red on both graphs, and it mirrors the influent concentration. So this confirms to us, or at least we're seeing evidence here, that advanced oxidation was not able to remove PFAS or PFOA from the water, because at the effluent of the HYPOX unit, we're seeing PFAS and PFOA concentrations pretty much the same, mimicking the influent concentrations. After a few time points, they stopped monitoring the concentration after the HYPOX system because they saw that it just was not working. So let's look at a little closer at PFOA, and this is just the carbon vessels. Before, I was showing you data from the entire system, and this is just the carbon vessels. So PFOA plant influent concentrations is shown in the purple line. So here we have our influent concentrations. That's the effluent concentrations. So the PFAS, the US EPA health advisory, is shown in this solid blue line. And our effluent concentrations of PFOA at the midpoint, so that is after the first tank, is shown in the green line. And notice, after some time, we start seeing the effluent PFOA concentration increasing, and then it goes beyond the health advisory. Then there was a change out of the vessel, change out of the carbon, and we see the concentrations decrease back down below the EPA health advisory. So this is just PFOA concentrations coming out of these carbon vessels. And we see as soon as we do that change out, PFOA concentration decreased. And now let's look at PFBA, which is one of those short chains. This is a 4-carbon chain, PFAS compounds. The PFB influent is shown in the blue line, and then the PFB effluent at the midpoint in the green line, and at the midpoint of the system in the green line, and at the end of the system in the purple line. So notice we have concentrations are pretty low, but then they start increasing. We don't have an EPA health advisory for PFBA, so we're just looking at what's happening to the concentrations. Then, so we see at the effluent, concentrations are increasing, both at the midpoint and at the end of the system. And you may look at this and say, so how can the effluent of the system have a higher concentration of PFOA than the influent of the system? Now, during Linda's presentation, she mentioned to you the possibility of precursors and precursors converting to PFOA or to PFBA. And actually, this slide is showing us PFBA. So that may be one of the reasons why we have PFBA concentrations at the effluent being higher than that of the influent, is because we have this hypox unit that may be oxidizing the precursors to PFBA, increasing the concentration of PFBA. So very interesting data here showing what can happen to the different PFAS compounds under both carbon and also this hypox unit. Okay, so let's move on and talk about ion exchange a little bit, another adsorption technology. Now, ion exchange, this is a synthetic material that's used to remove PFAS compounds. It can be single use or it can be regenerated. This is how the vendors sell the ion exchange resins. And it tends to be like an exchange. So the resin would absorb the PFAS compounds, which is anionic and has a negative charge, and release a negatively charged ion. And it's often in a lead-lag configuration. And as I mentioned, the mechanism is an ion exchange and also absorption. So there's both ion exchange and absorption taking place when you're using an ion exchange resin. And PFAS compounds are negatively charged, so they can absorb onto a positively charged an ion exchange medium. Now, what we've seen is that ion exchange seems to work better than GAC. The reaction kinetics are faster, and its operating capacity is also higher than GAC. However, it is more expensive. So that's one thing that you have to keep in mind there. At ion exchange, you tend to not have to change out the media as frequently because it has that higher capacity for PFAS compounds than GAC. And these graphs to the right just show different PFAS compounds, an 8-carbon PFAS, a 6-carbon, another 8-carbon, 4-carbon, 7-carbon, and a 6-carbon, and the percent removal of these different PFAS compounds by GAC versus ion exchange. So GAC is shown in the black bars, ion exchange is shown in the blue bars. And notice the ion exchange for each of these PFAS compounds performed better than GAC. We had up to 100% removal of these PFAS compounds after 146 days using the ion exchange, whereas the removal with GAC was less than 100% for each of these PFAS compounds. So you see here that ion exchange does work better than GAC, but keep in mind that it is more expensive. So when using ion exchange, keep in mind that you have to know what's in your source water pretty well. What's in your influent water? What kind of ions are there? Since this is an ion exchange mechanism, because you may have competition for different ions for these active sites. You may have competition from co-contaminants. Organic matter may even foul your resin. So it's important to do some small-scale bench tests before you actually implement a big system, so you can see how your specific water performs with this ion exchange resin. And I mentioned that the ion exchange resins, they can be single use or they can actually be regenerated. So there have been some being done by different ion exchange vendors on actually regenerating ion exchange, where they use brine solutions and also alcohols like methanol and ethanol to try to desorb the PFAS compounds from the ion exchange resin. And they have had some success with these solvents and also with chloride. So just be aware that you may not have to just dispose of your resin. You may be able to send it back to the vendor for regeneration. So let's look at a case study here where they actually compared activated carbon to ion exchange. This slide is showing you influent concentrations of this pilot study. Let's take a look at P4 and PFOS influent concentrations. P4 averaged about 12,000 parts per trillion, and PFOS averaged about 26,000 parts per trillion, which is much higher than the EPA health advisory of 70 ppt. So we have some very contaminated water here. And the system was set up with 4 GAC columns and 3 ion exchange columns, as you see here in this figure. So just a few pictures of the system, the GAC system. There were pre-filters to get rid of any organic carbon or any particulates that may foul the GAC. So we had the GAC tanks as well as ion exchange tanks in this pilot scale system. So let's take a look at some data and how these two systems performed. Our influent concentration of PFAS and PFOA are both shown in the black line. So as I mentioned, the influent concentration of PFAS was about 26,000 ppt. PFOA here has around 10,000 ppt of PFOA. The EPA health advisory is shown in a dashed red line, so we would like to stay below that EPA health advisory. So let's first see how GAC performed. There were multiple GAC vessels. Let's look at the lead versus the lag. The lead is shown in blue, the lag is shown in yellow. Notice we have breakthrough above this EPA health advisory around, let's say, about 5,000 or so bed volumes for the lag, and even maybe around 2,000 bed volumes for the lead system. But when we look at the ion exchange resin, which is shown in the lead, is shown in purple, and the lag is shown in green, notice we didn't see breakthrough until maybe 15,000 to 20,000 bed volumes in the lead system. And then in the lag system, after 20,000 bed volumes, we still did not see breakthrough of this PFAS. So in this case, GAC did perform better than the ion exchange resin for PFAS. Now let's take a look at PFOA. Again, our influent concentration was about 10,000 ppt. Then our effluent from the GAC, which is shown in blue and yellow, around, let's say, 5 to 4,000 bed volumes, we start seeing breakthrough. Whereas for the ion exchange resin, the breakthrough is happening here, maybe around 8,000 bed volumes or around 12,000 bed volumes. So the ion exchange is performing better than the GAC in this pilot scale system. Okay, let's take a look at a couple of shorter chain carbons, PFBA, PFBS. Influent concentrations are shown by the dashed line. Influent concentrations are shown by the dashed line, and then effluent concentrations in blue and green. The GAC, in both instances, we saw higher concentrations in the effluent sooner at lower bed volumes. So again, the ion exchange resin is performing better, even for these shorter chain carbons, the PFBA and the PFBS. So some regeneration was tried with the ion exchange resin. As I mentioned to you, they use brine, they use some alcohols to regenerate the resin. Then both virgin and regenerated resin were tested, and notice that the bed volumes treated by the virgin in this purple line and by the regenerated resin in the yellow line, they mimicked each other. So that lets us know that both the virgin and the regenerated ion exchange resin performed very similarly to each other. So just a summary of this case study. Both the GAC and the ion exchange were able to remove the PFOS and PFOA, but it's very clear that the ion exchange resin performed better than the granular activated carbon. So just to mention just a couple other technologies here. One technology out there on the market is PlumeStop, which is a colloidal activated carbon that's being marketed for in-situ treatment. Before I said most of our technologies were for ex-situ treatment, but this can actually be applied in-situ to remove PFAS from water. This is how this is being marketed. So what happens with PlumeStop is you inject the PlumeStop, it coats the surface of the soil, and then as the contaminated groundwater flows past this PlumeStop, the PFAS gets absorbed onto the PFAS. So it's not a disruptive technology, but it tends to immobilize the PFAS in place. And there have been a few field trials currently in the U.S. And just to mention one other technology, I mentioned the electrochemical oxidation technology. This one is becoming a little bit more popular. And there's one technology that has been patented called D-fluoro-TM, where the PFAS compounds are oxidized using electrochemical oxidation. And this can mineralize C4 to C8 carbon, so like the PFBSs all the way up to PFOS and PFOA. I don't believe this is currently commercially available, but they are working on it. So not only can it be used to remove PFAS from drinking water, it's been tested on Regeneron solutions from ion exchange resin and also PFAS-impacted wastewater. So just be aware that this technology may be coming up to the forefront more as it is commercialized. Okay, now we'll spend the next, 5 minutes or so, talking about some soil treatment technologies. So the mechanisms are in-situ stabilization or excavation or thermal remediation. Those are pretty much the technologies available for soil treatment. And for in-situ stabilization, it's modified carbon or modified minerals, both of which are commercialized and can be purchased from vendors. You can also excavate your soil, take it to a landfill, or take it to an incinerator. And we know these are commercialized. They've been used for other contaminants. Now, when it comes to landfills, PFAS is not considered hazardous, so it can pretty much go to any non-hazardous landfill. However, not all landfills want to accept the waste, so that's the want to accept the contaminated soil. So that's one thing to look into. Some landfills are worried about future liability and leaching. So before you attempt to take your PFAS contaminated soil to a landfill, check and make sure that they are willing and able to take it. So in-situ stabilization, so we've used this technology for other contaminants, and now there are some technologies out there that allow it to be used for PFAS compounds, where you stabilize your PFAS compounds in the soil so that it doesn't leach. This was developed overseas. The technology is available in the U.S., but has been developed overseas and used more overseas. So we'll talk about Rembine Plus. This is an aluminum-based sorbent that was developed in Australia. It has aluminum hydroxide, activated carbon, organic matter, kaolinite, and a few other proprietary materials. And this can be used to sorb PFAS in soil. The vendors suggest that you apply it to the soil in about a 2 to 5% by weight, adjust the moisture content, and binding occurs as fast as in 24 hours. And it has been pilot tested for water treatment as well. And what happens here, as I mentioned, this is a sorption process for your PFAS. They're not getting destroyed. They're being sorbed. They're being sorbed by hydrophobic and electrostatic interactions, and the rembine holds onto your PFAS compounds. So let's look at a small case study here where they were redoing an airport taxiway, and they had about 900 tons of PFAS-contaminated soil. So let's see what they did at this site. So they excavated these 900 tons of PFAS-contaminated soil, which had concentrations of about 5.7 or so milligrams per kilogram. And this cartoon of this guy looking at the soil, I think, is how we all look at our PFAS sites. Like, oh my gosh, I have PFAS contamination. What am I going to do with it? So let's see what they did at this site. At this site, they took the 900 tons of soil. They actually took it to a landfill. But what they did at the landfill is that they dug a very specific burial cell for this PFAS-contaminated waste. And what they did is they lined that cell with rembine. Linda mentioned in her presentation about the possibility of leaching of PFAS. So to help prevent this leaching, they lined this landfill cell with some rembine before they placed the contaminated soil in that cell and then covered it with a rembine cap. And this, they actually did this in a landfill. You can see in these pictures here, you can tell they're working in a landfill. There's all this trash everywhere. But they dug this cell in the landfill, added the contaminated soil, put a lining of rembine, and then covered it with rembine as well. And this was done in Australia, and their compliance limit for soil leachate after treatment is around 0.2 micrograms per liter. And from their monitoring, concentrations were always below that 0.2 micrograms per liter. So they considered this a success. And I have to thank Richard Stewart from Ziltech for providing me with these slides. Now, how much does this cost? You look at these costs here, I converted them into US dollars, and it comes out with everything, landfill fees, any investigation, bench guilt trials. It comes up to about 117 US dollars per ton, so not an insignificant cost, about $117 per ton for this type of treatment. And this was done within the last 5 years or so, so these are relevant cost numbers. Now, at this site, they actually checked to see, this is now a different case study, where they checked to see, okay, can rembine be used to treat water contaminated with PFAS compounds? At this site, they had two full-scale GAC systems, two 20,000-pound GAC systems. But they decided, let's see, can rembine also remove PFAS from water? Influent concentration was around 5,000 nanograms per liter, ppt, of PFAS. So what they did, simple study, set up a 30-gallon batch reactor. It held 30 gallons of water. They added the rembine to this tank and let it sit for 24 hours. At the end of 24 hours, they decanted the treated water, added some more contaminated water, and did this for about 2 weeks, treating about 280 gallons of water and monitoring for both PFAS compounds as well as TOC. So let's see how this system performed. Looking at these graphs, we see pretreatment concentrations of PFAS over the time varied from about, pretreatment concentrations was about maybe 2,000 to about 4,000 ppt. And the removal percentage by the rembine was about 90% or higher. So the rembine actually worked pretty well to remove the PFAS from water. And you can see the sorbed mass of PFAS and P4 in this lower graph. It did much better with PFAS, sorbing a lot more PFAS than it did P4. So just to summarize what we talked about here today, to ensure that we have a few minutes for questions, GAC is being used a lot. Some people consider it the only practical treatment for groundwater to date, but we saw in this presentation that we can use ion exchange as well as GAC. Ion exchange performed better than the activated carbon, and the bituminous carbon actually performed better than the coconut carbon in the studies that we saw. Ion exchange resin is better, but keep in mind it is more expensive. And there are some in-situ treatment technologies being developed and out there, plume stuff being one of them for treating water in-situ. And then we have soil treatment technologies like Rembind that are out there that can remove, that can sorb PFAS out of soil. So here are just a few references. There are also references on the slides. You can see the references where the data came from. So that's it. This presentation was given by my coworker at FRTR a few months back. So both my contact information and his contact information is there in case you have any questions beyond what's discussed today. So to ensure we have some time for questions, I'll wrap up now and see what you guys have to ask.
Thank you, Rama. Yes, we have had plenty of questions coming in. Unfortunately, I don't think we'll have time to get to all of them, but we'll give you a few. First off, let me just back up for a minute. Someone asked if GAC efficiency is affected by water hardness. Can you talk about that a little?
By water hardness? You know, I haven't heard that it's affected by water hardness, mainly by TOC. I can see resins and ion exchange resins being affected by water hardness because of the ions in the water, but not that I know of with GAC.
Okay. Now, and I think you probably touched on this back earlier in your presentation about what the sorption capacity is for GAC with PFAS compounds. Can you discuss that a little more, please?
Okay, so it varies by PFAS, by compound itself. It has a better capacity for PFAS than it does PFOA, and probably PFBS than it does PFBA. So the capacity varies by compound and also based on your water chemistry. So it's recommended to do a small-scale test, and like this rapid small-scale test that I mentioned earlier in the presentation. You can have the vendor actually do this rapid small-scale test and let you know how your specific water chemistry will perform in the presence of GAC in terms of removing the PFAS. So it varies based on a few different parameters.
Okay, excellent. Thank you. Now, back to when you were discussing ion exchange, can you talk a little about how concentrated that waste stream from ion exchange regeneration is?
So that would be a pretty concentrated waste stream because you're actually pulling any PFAS that got sorbed onto the resin into the waste stream. They're using the brine or the methanol. So yeah, it would be a pretty concentrated waste stream. And, you know, they've looked into different technologies to break down the PFAS from this waste stream.
Okay. And how would you say ion exchange compares to GAC as far as sustainability is concerned? Like, for example, water use or how energy intensive it is or waste management. Can you discuss the two of those in comparison a little bit?
Okay, so in terms of like the development of the ion exchange, like actually making the ion exchange versus the GAC, I'm not too sure. But right now, they can regenerate the ion exchange. So you can extend the life of the ion exchange. You're not replacing it as often, so you're using it longer, and then you can also regenerate it. So that definitely helps with the sustainability. There's single use and there's regenerable. So selecting the regenerable ion exchange would definitely be more sustainable and allow you to use it much longer.
Okay, and is one of these methods significantly more expensive than the other, or is that usually a big component of the decision of which method to go with?
Yes, the resins are definitely more expensive than GAC, so that's something to look into. You know, you work with a vendor to figure out what size system to use and how many pounds of resin or GAC you need to put in your system to help you make that decision. They can also advise you on how frequently you may have to change out, so then you can do the financial comparisons.
Okay, great. Let's see. Got a handful of other questions in here, and they're still pouring in, but let's see. Jean, you think we have time for another couple questions?
Yeah, let's try to do two more if we can.
Okay. Let's see. So, Ramona, do you know of any other porous materials other than GAC that are in consideration for commercial scale deployment right now? Or are there any others that you've heard about that you think may have some promise?
Okay, I'm thinking here.
Or does it seem that we've covered most of them?
Yeah, they're, you know, people are experimenting with like zeolites and clays and other minerals to remove PFAS from water. But right now, you know, GAC is number one. But people are doing, if you look at the research, there's research looking at different minerals to remove PFAS from water.
Okay, so maybe we'll hear more about that in the future. Now, someone asked about thermal treatment for PFAS in contaminated soil. I'm not sure if they're talking about in situ or ex situ, but they asked how effective thermal is for PFAS soils.
So thermal actually works pretty well, and I've been involved in some small-scale studies removing PFAS from soil using thermal, and it seems to be working pretty well. There's a lot of research going on right now on that. There are a couple systems that are available commercially, systems that you can bring to your site, add your soil to the system, and thermally remove the PFAS. There are some concerns with what's actually coming off and what's volatilizing off of the soil, concerns about HF being produced, concerns about the PFAS volatilizing and how you actually would treat your off gas. But I would say yes, thermal works. We've seen it work where the soil concentrations of different PFAS is down by 90-something percent after using thermal at concentrations above 600 degrees Fahrenheit. You can go up to 1,000 plus degrees Fahrenheit. And yes, it does work. It's, however, under more research to really understand better what's volatilizing off when you do add that amount of heat to the soil.
Great. Excellent point. Okay, thank you, Ramona. I think at this point we're going to wrap things up. I do want to remind you that this is only the first of a series on this topic. There's definitely plenty more to say about PFAS. So we're going to have another upcoming presentation. It will be later this year. That will include two more talks by presenters from the FRTR meeting. So this will be September 26th, and you can register for that now if you go to that link. We'll have two speakers. One will discuss specifically more of the considerations for when you're sampling for PFAS, both in the lab and out in the field. So if you're interested in that, please come back, check that out. And then next, I will pass it over to Jean for some more reminders.
Okay, great. Thank you so very much, Cindy. I'll just walk us through a few quick final reminders. If you are interested in participating in webinars like this, I encourage you to visit us at the Cleanup Information Network at cluin.org. You can also sign up for one of our free monthly newsletters, excuse me, for example, Tech Direct, which goes out on the first of each month. There's a number of resources up there that we also make available on other contracting opportunities in the area of hazardous waste site cleanup as well. So take a look, browse, enjoy our resources, and please be sure to connect with us for future events. For those of you who are looking for copies of the presentation materials, they're already available to download from the seminar resources or links page. If you look on the right side of your screen, you'll see under related URLs a number of items. One of them says seminar resources. You can click the link to select it and then press the browse to button to open it up on your own computer. For those of you who were asking about when the updated item was going to be released to the docket that Linda had mentioned, we will post that link when it's available on the seminar resources page, and hopefully we'll be able to include that as part of the archive email that we'll send to each of you when the recorded version of this webinar is made available. So I encourage you to keep your eyes tuned into your inbox to look for information. As soon as we have it, we'll be sure to share it with you. If you would like, you can also share your thoughts on today's webinar using our online feedback form. One of the most common questions I get is if we offer CEUs or PDHs or some sort of a credit for attending these webinars. While we don't issue those types of certifications or credit hours, we will give you a participation certificate after you submit feedback. So I would encourage you to follow the link on the middle right of your screen to the feedback form, fill it out, make sure your email address is entered in there correctly, and that you check the box at the bottom of the form to certify you were here for the whole event. Then as soon as you submit feedback, you'll have immediate access to a webinar certificate like this one that you can either print out or save for your own records. If you join together in a group in a conference room setting, you can still click the link to that seminar feedback form, even if you didn't register individually. So I would encourage the one who did register to share the link to the feedback form with those who joined you in the room, and each person can fill out their own feedback form to get their own certificate. For those of you who joined only by phone, again, if you registered for today's webinar, you have a link in your instructions to the seminar homepage, and that feedback form is available right from the seminar homepage, so you can go back to that email to access the form. And with that, again,